Great, and now I'm beginning recording.
Okay.
19th. Yes.
17.
So Mitch, what do you want to tell us about your experience 50 years ago?
I probably don't have the most vivid story to tell, especially after 50 years. So a lot of it is kind of vague, but I was there. And I was, at the time I was involved in SDS and various other things. And and we decided that we were going to protest the recruiting by Dow. I think something that I just remembered was that there had been, Dow had come the year before, somewhere in the winter.
66.
And I think they were interviewing at the engineering campus then.
Yes.
And people went there, but some other people went and occupied the chancellor's office.
Okay.
At Bascom Hall. And after all of that, the chancellor went to the faculty, had the faculty meeting, and asked for authorization to call in the city police.
Mm-hmm.
If something like that happened again. I always called that his Gulf of Tonkin resolution. Because
yes.
And
you know,
and at that point, it was not, it was considered, you didn't expect the city police to come in there.
Right.
And
although you guys were warned.
Well, we were warned, but, the university was this city on a hill, this ivory tower there, and you didn't really expect the cops to come in there. And the cops at that time were, when they finally came, we could see there were reasons why we didn't want them there. It was October 18th, right? The night before, the San Francisco Mime Troupe was in town.
Sorry, you said day before, you mean the...
The night before, the evening of the 17th.
Yes.
The San Francisco Mime Troupe.
Oh.
He was in town, and they were, I don't know if you've ever heard of them.
No, I haven't.
But they were a radical theater group.
Okay.
From San Francisco that performed. They started off, I guess, doing mime, doing commedia dell'arte, and
mm-hmm.
things, but they always political, and they became just more explicitly political, and they were doing this show which had the form of a minstrel show.
Minstrel.
A minstrel show. You know what a minstrel show is? It's American
sorry.
American
yeah.
history there. It,
yeah.
it was a kind of performance that happened in the 19th century, in the 1800s, in which performers they'd wear blackface.
Oh.
And they would play banjos and danced and did things like this. It was sort of built on racial stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes black people would wear blackface to get even blacker and do these performances. Really? And so the mime troupe was doing this this show, you know, kind of ironically, you know, to talk about race. And it was very powerful, as I remember. And at the end of it, they told everybody to come to the demonstration the next day against Dow recruiting. And, the next day, you know, so there were some people who had decided that they were going, you know, it was in the Commerce Building, which is now Ingram Hall. And they had decided that they were going to sit in the corridor and obstruct the recruiting, the interviewing. And then there were a lot of us who were just basically there to support them. And that included me. And so I was there, you know, and it started out as being kind of a festive atmosphere. Everybody was having lots of fun. The people were sitting there. We were cheering them on. I remember I was selling cookies as a fundraiser for another activist group, the committee.
In the building?
Well, I'm basically outside. I was trying to send, you know, sell them and trying to raising money for the Committee for Direct Action. And then at some point I went inside and I was at the back of the corridor where everybody else was sitting.
Yeah.
And then suddenly I heard glass smashing.
Oh.
And, I ran out to the front to see what was happening. And, all hell was breaking loose. And, you know, I didn't see it, but, you know, heard about it is that, you know, the cops were going in and, instead of just, you know, what everybody expected was that they would pick up the demonstrators and carry them off and take them downtown and process them. But what they were doing was they were clubbing them. And, you know, and I mean, I never figured out why they broke the glass. I mean, it had no, you know, even for what they were attempting to do, it had no useful connection to, you know, but when, you know, so anyway, that went on for a while. And the people gathered around, you know, kind of, you know, this crowd formed outside the entrance there. And the cops came out, and there they were, and they were, you know, I mean, they were surrounded by a crowd of very angry people. So they started swinging their clubs at everybody there. And people were, you know, they would chase people back, and then they would come back, and, you know, this happened, and for, I don't remember how long. So there were a lot of people with blood running down their faces, because you hit somebody on the top of the head, there's a lot of blood vessels there. So people get, you know, pretty spectacularly bloody. And so, it was just, you know, just kind of bedlam there. And at some point, they started throwing tear gas. It took us a while to figure out what was going on there, because nobody had seen tear gas. Nobody had any idea that they would do this kind of thing. I think tear gas was probably something we read about.
Yes.
So, I mean, when our eyes started tearing, there were these clouds of stuff coming out, and our eyes started tearing. Then, we knew what it was, and that kind of got people, you know. Well, it broke up the whole pattern of everything, of course, you know. And, it was such a new thing that the police didn't know how to use it either, really. I mean, they didn't have anything to protect their faces. They threw the stuff, and then they tried to stay upwind.
And you sense from that they were not trained well to use.
They weren't trained well to do anything, because that's not how you deal with a a demonstration. I mean, even if, you know, even if you've decided that you're going to get, you know, remove that obstruction, you don't, you know, this is pouring gasoline on the fire. And of course, they got worse and worse at that, you know, so that they would, you know, I mean, we had, you know, several years in which they would just make everything worse. You know, when we had the Mifflin Street thing, Mifflin Street block party, and they wanted to get everybody, to go home and go into their apartments, but they went and threw tear gas into the apartments.
When was that?
That was a few years later, you know.
Oh.
That was, you know, I mean, at this point, it was just stunning and startling, and nobody knew what to do with it. After a while, it became something you'd expect a few times a year.
Oh, so you mean
because
you expected
the
tear gas?
They would always be, there would always be something, you know. There would either be a demonstration or just something. They would pick a fight or something like that. So that went on for years, but this was the start there.
Have you heard the police announced the ultimatum of saying students coming out or they are going to storm in the building, or you didn't hear them saying?
I didn't hear it because I guess they did say something.
Okay.
I think they might have said, this is an unlawful assembly or something like that.
I see.
I don't remember that, but I think people said that they got the bullhorn and they mumbled something.
And did you recall any, did you still have any impression of the UW campus police chief? I believe the name is Ralph Hansen.
Ralph Hansen.
Yeah, what do you think of him? Like, did he, he
was
appear that day?
I think he was probably the one who, you know, who made that announcement, such as it is.
Oh.
But the you know, the violence was from city cops.
Yes.
Right. The campus police were a lot smarter about that. they were manipulative, you know, but that's in a way that's kind of their job, you know. I remember him kind of, you know, leading the demonstrators around and things like that. You know, after David Cooper became police chief, we started thinking of the campus police as the hard asses, and the city police were the ones who knew how to diffuse a situation. But it was totally the opposite at that point.
Oh, I see.
Right. And later on, you know, I mean, when the sheriff's police kind of got into it, they were really terrible. I mean, you know, but that's kind of getting out of this particular event.
And yeah. Thanks for letting us know your experience on that day. And I'm on a further inquiry. How did you get involved in the SDS? And what year were you?
I was a second year grad student.
Second year graduate student.
Right. As a high school student in New York, I'd been involved with a kind of a precursor to SDS. And then I went to a small college and we had an SDS, not a particularly militant SDS chapter, you know, and SDS at that point was not the SDS of the later, you know, the later years when they were smashing windows and everything like that. It was sort of inspired by the civil rights movement in a lot of ways, and
civil obedience thing,
well, but
style.
And community organizing and you know, they really didn't plan, from my understanding, you know, from what was happening often, you know, the center, you know, where all this stuff was happening. They really weren't eager to get involved in opposing the Vietnam War, because that kind of took over everything, you know. That was, but you know, there was no way you could avoid it. I mean, it was there. You had to oppose it. You couldn't just sit by and say, well, we're doing you know, community organizing of, you know, unemployed workers and things like that. I mean, you know, so they got into that and it superheated everything, I think.
Speaking of the organization, I'm just wondering about the second DAO demonstration. Did anyone notify you to do something, or like, did you know any of the organization part of this event? Like, clearly there must be someone in SDS organizing all the demonstration, right? No.
I'm sure. I mean, there was some. I don't remember the dates. I mean, okay. I went to at least the open planning meeting.
Oh, there is a.
There was. I mean, you know, the people. You know, it was a meeting, and we decided we were going to do, you know, this. I read something, you know, somebody said that there was a peaceful demonstration the day before. Mm. He was probably there, but I don't remember it. It was agreed that some people would do civil disobedience and other people would be there to support them. Mm. And the planning, you know, SDS, you know, made a major principle of being open and not doing things secretly. That changed later on when things got really, really scary, and you know, and but at that point, I mean, that was the idea, is that, you know, there was not an inner circle, at least not formally an inner circle that was going to make these decisions and communicate them down to the base or anything like that, you know. So I don't think they might. I don't know if there were any like peacekeepers and things like that, you know, people who were charged, you know, with keeping things going or anything like that. Mm. I mean, and I think it was also that there was not a lot of experience in running mass demonstrations at that point. I mean, SCS had organized national demonstrations and things, and I'm, you know, I'd gone to some of those. I went to the March on Washington, and that would have been 65, I think.
So for the
first national,
from...
the first national anti-war march.
You took a bus from Madison.
In the Kalamazoo, because that was when I was still. I would have been a junior at the time.
Okay, in the college you were talking about.
At the college, yeah. It sort of introduced us to the wide world. We saw, you know, people from all over. I mean, we were just this little group, this little college. You know, and so I'm sure there was, you know, that they organized marshals and things like that. You can't have 40,000 people without having some kind of organization like that. But I don't think there was very much of that.
Mm. You didn't sense that much chain of command.
No, they didn't.
You
believe
just
in chains.
Open meetings.
They didn't believe in chains of command.
But how did you guys raise hand to vote on things, like the decisions in protesting or not, sitting? Who's gonna
sit? I don't remember if there were votes. I think, you know, there might have been, but I don't know if there were any disagreements about what we should be doing.
Ah, I see. And that was the meeting was. How many days before the
I don't
end?
Remember that.
Okay, but there, it was definitely sometime before.
You know, maybe a few days before. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was a whole bunch of stuff happening. I'm pretty sure that SDS or people related to SDS brought the mime troop to town.
Mime? Oh yeah.
The San Francisco mime troop, and they. You know, but I'm not sure, you know, I mean, I'm not sure how exactly that was arranged for. I mean, they were at the Union Theater, so there must have been some formal arrangements there. But, you know, and, you know, so there was that, there was the, you know, the demonstration on the 17th. The demonstration on the 18th, and then the next day,
strike.
Well, there was a strike, and sometime after that, let's see, would have that have been like a Thursday? Do you remember?
Thursday, yes.
Yeah, that a lot of us, there was a national demonstration in Washington, and I went off for that.
Oh, that one, I don't know the day, but...
that was by the weekend.
Thursday, yeah.
Yeah, so, okay, so we got on the buses on Friday, most likely, and, you know, and went to Washington and came back. I think it was Washington. Don't think it was New York.
That was also an entire Vietnam.
Yeah, so it was, I mean, there was a lot of stuff happening then. I remember we gathered in the social science, and some people from the mime troupe, we had a discussion about the meaning of all this, and I remember them writing on the board revolution, you know, that's what we were talking about, you know, even though most people at that point were pretty generally reformists.
I see.
Yeah.
And would you tell us a bit more how... It seems you were always a student activist, and would you describe...
Just, not a very hardcore one. But,
when did you really realize that you are going to be a political actor in those kind of events? Like, what motivated you to participate in
it? I guess, I kind of grew up with that, my parents... I wouldn't say I was a red diaper baby, maybe a pink diaper baby, you know, but my mother was involved and, as a student, she was involved in, you know, communist-related organizations and things like that, although, you know, the McCarthy era scared her.
Yeah.
So we were very quiet then, but there was just, you know, the general feeling, you know, that we were, you know, we supported civil rights.
Yeah.
I did things in high school. I was involved in a piece, this Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy, and supporting the Woolworth sit-ins and things like that. And then when I carried on with that when I went to college, you know, and I wasn't one of these people who lived activism, but I was generally sympathetic with that.
I see.
Yeah.
Oh,
one little thing that I remember that, I lived in it was a co-op that was related to the Quaker meeting, and one of the people there, was a music student. She had keys to the carillon, and while all of this crazy stuff was happening, she was in the carillon playing Dona Nobis Pacem. Give us peace.
Sorry, I don't have any say on this topic.
No. You've heard that Dona Nobis Pacem.
What was that about?
It's give us peace.
Give us peace.
In Latin, yeah, and I think it's a. I don't know. I don't know where it comes out of. You know, the church.
Mm.
So she was playing that while we were, and I didn't know about that. You didn't notice the carillon when all this stuff was happening down below, but that was happening up. You know, you've been to the place. You know, it was right outside of that carillon there.
Mm.
So.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
Well.
I'm
just wondering if you could give us a brief chronology up till October 1867, like where you were born and where did you go to college?
Well, I was born in New York,
yeah,
and I went to, I went to high school in New York. I went to the Bronx High School of Science, which was kind of a hotbed of of activism, and a lot of it's sort of where the old left was turning into the new left, I guess.
Oh.
You know, the classes ahead of me, Stokely Carmichael was, I think, 2 years ahead of me. You know who Stokely Carmichael is?
No.
He was, do you know who Stokely Carmichael?
No.
Oh, you should. He was... He was a very prominent black activist. Mm-hmm. He was in he was in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and he became more and more active, and eventually he ended up moving to Guinea and changing his name to Kwame Ture and marrying Miriam Makeba. But anyway, he was a famous, you know, and but there were a lot of people. There were a lot of people who were children of communists and things like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a lot of. It was sort of in the atmosphere there that there were a lot of old lefties in the Bronx.
I see.
And so I was kind of absorbed that, and then I went to Kalamazoo College, which was totally different, being in the Midwest, and. Very few Jews and no communists and things like that, but it did have kind of a it was Baptist, but it was a liberal Baptist. That I mean, it was, there were the sort of it was American Baptist Convention, and so they were the sort of people who saw support for civil rights and peace as a religious obligation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then
I went to grad school in math.
Math.
Yeah.
Wow, that was a pretty long journey, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. So
great. And I'm just wondering if you have anything to add to contribute to our story collection.
No, I think I've already said more than I was expecting to say, but let's see. No, I mean, I think you can probably trace a direct line from this to like the Sterling Hall bombing.
Oh, what?
Not in the sense that we were violent, primed for that kind of thing, but the way we were treated in this kind of open-hearted, the demonstration, that was going to be peaceful and civil disobedience, basically inspired by the, by what we'd seen in the South, and to get clubbed like that. And then, it became something that happened every few months.
Mm.
And it created some people who just weren't going to take it anymore, and they ended up, getting fuel oil and fertilizer and blowing up that building.
As a single.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah.
I see.
If the authorities had treated us differently, I think things would have happened differently. And maybe you can draw a line from all of that to Trump. But I'm not the one to argue that rigorously.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Mitch.
Oh, thank you.